The Skeptic Society and John Wagner Studios are proud to present Dr. Michael Shermer's College Courses on Audio. Presented by Dr. Michael Shermer and produced by John Wagner for the Skeptic Society. I'm John Wagner, the producer of these audio courses. War is one of the four courses taught by Dr. Michael Shermer that the Skeptic Society has decided to bring out for public consumption. The other three are History of Science, Psychology, and Evolution. Dr. Shermer started teaching at Glendale College, then moved to California State University, Los Angeles, and finished at Occidental College in Los Angeles, spanning the years 1990 to 1998. Dr. Shermer left the Academy to direct the Skeptic Society, publish Skeptic Magazine, write his monthly column for Scientific American, host the Caltech Science Lecture Series, and write books full-time. In his 18 years of teaching, however, he honed his lecture skills to become one of the most popular professors on campus. A brief look at war, history, causes, and solutions. This course contains 41 lectures for total running time of about 32 hours. In this course, Dr. Shermer mixes straight narrative history with science, philosophy, and theory as to the causes and solutions to war. The course begins with an overview of war and terms and conditions as they will be used throughout this course. The detailed history begins with the rise of the nation-state, particularly in the form of the Ancien Régime of France, and how its abuses led to the French Revolution and the rise and fall of Napoleon. The next set of lectures take us from the origins of American slavery through the Civil War, its social and political background, the steps leading up to it, and the battles themselves, all showing how war shifted from medieval wars fought by professional soldiers to modern total war that encompasses all of the participating societies. The scene then shifts back to Europe, with the backdrop to the two world wars, starting with Marx, Marxism, and the Russian Revolution. The First World War and its disastrous consequences that allowed for the rise to power of Mussolini and the fascists and Hitler and the Nazis. The narrative history portion of the course ends with the building and dropping of the atomic bomb. The final two lectures explore the proximate and ultimate causes of all wars using the sciences of psychology, social psychology, sociology, and anthropology to explore political solutions to the prevention of war. Note, since these courses were taped in the classroom, there is a certain amount of extemporaneous dialogue and student comments and questions that accompany the lecture material, adding color to the courses. Dr. Shermer is an animated lecturer who mixes wit and humor with serious scholarly and scientific material. To preserve the integrity and continuity of these courses, some files had to be enhanced for acceptable clarity. These lectures were originally delivered in the spring of 1996 at Glendale College. Copyright 2009, Michael Shermer, all rights reserved. I'm John Wagner. Please enjoy Michael Shermer's course on war, history, causes, and solutions.
Okay, this is Social Science 136. The history of war, or more specifically, war, history, causes, and solutions. I presume you're in the right class. I've had you before, haven't I? Psych?
No, biology.
Evolution, right. A couple semesters ago, I remember. Last semester? Okay, fair enough. I get too many students in classes, I lose track here. Okay, this is a three-unit course. We meet Monday nights, 6:30 to 9:30. I generally go right up till 9:30. This evening, I have to leave a little bit early, so we'll work around that, take a little bit shorter break, and get out a little bit early. The bookstore has your books, I presume. Has anyone gotten the books yet already? All right, these are the three books. The Kennedy book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. The Sun Tzu book, the famed The Art of War, and Jeffrey Blaney's book, The Causes of War. These are all three under my name over in the Social Science section in the bookstore. They're all paperbacks now, even though the ones up here I have are hardback. So the cost will be considerably less. And along with that is a syllabus, which is not there yet. It won't be there until probably next Monday. And this is the syllabus. It's just the name of the course, and just says course syllabus on it. Basically what this is my lecture notes without all the detailed notes in between. It's all the quotes, major statistics, lengthy speeches that people gave, and things like that. So when I'm sitting up here reading a quote, you can sort of follow along in the syllabus. This I didn't do until the end of the last semester. Last semester was the first time I taught this course. So it takes you a full semester to write the lecture notes for a course. It's quite an ordeal. And so I finally didn't put this together until the very end, and the students used this to study for their notes. But what we found out was that by trying it toward the end of the course, the last few lectures, the students could follow along with my reading lengthy quotes from Hitler or, you know, whoever, Roosevelt or whatever, and it made the course a lot more interesting and easier to follow. So get this. And also on the final exam, you'll have a quote matching test, which the students all did really well. They almost all got A's on the quote matching test. In other words, I might have a quote from somebody. I'll have a list of quotes from individuals and then a list of the names of who said them. Roosevelt and Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin and Lenin and Napoleon and so on, and you match who said what with what. And so by having this, that'll make it a lot easier. Also diagrams and graphs and stuff like that, then I don't have to put quite so much on the board. And you can just, you know, maps of battle plans of Gettysburg and Ypres and all some of the major battle plans of World War I and World War II and so on are all in there. So that's kind of a nifty thing to have just for your notes. That'll save you a lot of note-taking so that the notes you take will be structural outline notes for the purposes of sort of concepts that make sure you get rather than a lot of super details. Okay, now the books, let me say a few words about the books. Primarily, the history part of the course we will use The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers by Paul Kennedy. This is considered to be a classic in its time. It's a bestseller, and this guy has won several history awards for this book. Just recently came out about 2 years ago. The book really deals with the last 500 years of warfare, but it's not a book on battles and generals and strategies. It's a book about the causes of war deeper than that, the politics, the economics. And his thesis, and you might as well make a note of this now, Kennedy's thesis is that the cause of wars, that what makes one nation stronger than another nation, is its economic potential, its ability to produce war goods, its population potential to produce goods as well as be war consumers, that is, bodies to die. As we'll see when we do World War I, the basic strategy of the West, that is, the Allies, was to simply outlast the Germans. We may lose more than they do, but we have 10 times as many people to die than they do. So if we just keep up the killing machine, then eventually we'll win. All right. So they had greater potential for that. And his whole thesis is a buildup from 1500 till today, roughly the year 2000, as to why the world looks like it does today. Unfortunately, this book came out 2 years ago and things are changing rather rapidly in the East. But still, his premise, I think, holds that Russia and the United States inevitably had to rise as the two great sort of bipolar world on the planet because of their size and economic potential, the raw materials to build war goods and the technology and the pure raw population. All right, so that's Kennedy's thesis. It's, I think, a pretty good read. It's not a boring book, but there's a lot of detailed information on it. And in the syllabus, there is a detailed outline of the course, what the sort of the sequence we'll be going in, and where you should be in the book at what particular time in the course. So be sure and follow along with that and bug me every week to tell you where we should be. But basically, we're having two regular exams and a final. So there'll be a rather lengthy time span between now and the first test, and between the first test and the second test. And basically, it'll go like this. The first test will consist of the introductory material, sort of a brief introduction to the causes of war and the history of war, which we'll do tonight. And then the French Revolution and Napoleon and the rise of the Napoleonic dynasty and then Napoleonic Wars. And then the American Civil War. And probably the Russian Revolution. That'll take us to the first test. Then the second test will be World War I and World War II. And I do the whole sequence leading up to World War I, the causes, the war, the period of time in between the wars. I'll do the rise of the fascists and Mussolini, the rise of the Nazis and Hitler, and I'll give you detailed, beautiful lecture notes on both of those two gentlemen, if you want to call them that, Hitler and Mussolini, as well as Lenin and Stalin and the Russians, and then the causes of World War II, the World War itself, and then that will take us, and then, I build the atomic bomb for you, and then we'll drop the bomb, and that'll end the second unit, so you'll have a test there. Then the final exam will consist of just the last unit of material, the causes and solutions to war, and the matching quotes stuff that I told you about that'll cover the whole course. So the final is sort of a review of the entire course through the quotes and then covering the last part of the material. All right. Okay, so that takes us, that's sort of a 2-minute summary of the course. Yes? Well, yeah, Korea and Vietnam, I will cover sort of a follow-up to Kennedy's thesis that Russia and the United States would inevitably rise to this giant bipolar world. Everything that's happened since then has really been a spin-off of conflicts between these two nations. But since these two nations are so huge, they cannot have a war. They have to, and because that war would consist of nuclear fighting, which would consist of total destruction if it carried itself out. Therefore, wars must be fought in the old style, conventional warfare. And we can't have a big conventional war because that would lead to a nuclear war, so we have to have little police actions, as they're called, with quotation marks around it. And that's really what Korea and Vietnam were attempts to fight the conventional war without letting it get too far into a nuclear potential. Okay, so we'll spend a little bit of time on that when we do the causes. That's a very popular subject now, isn't it, the Vietnam War? Why do you suppose that is? Why do you think there's all these movies and so on about that conflict? Controversial, yeah. Why was it controversial? Yeah.
Well, the first time that this country didn't support, the general consensus didn't support the war, unlike Korea or World War II.
It wasn't a good war, right? There wasn't clear-cut bad guys and clear-cut good guys where we needed to get revenge upon these people and all rally behind. And as we'll see at the beginning of World War II for the United States entry into it, it's very likely that Roosevelt knew that not only were the Japanese going to attack somewhere, but that they were probably going to attack at Pearl Harbor. And he probably let it happen. Simply, but why would he want to just let it happen? Yeah. That's right. Not only Congress, but the United States was very much split between the warmongers and the isolationists. A huge faction of the country were isolationists. They didn't want anything to do with the European war. And this would get us into it in a big way, because we would have to revenge our loss. And also world sympathy. You know, nations can no longer operate in a vacuum. Nations need the support of other nations. And so revenge against an attacking aggressor, who especially had a surprise attack on you, is a great reason to get other nations to support you. All right, so it's part of a political game here, as we'll see. Sure.
Vietnam War, while we're talking about it, could it be letting off of shame and anger? Anger with people that maybe didn't go, and shameful for not going. Maybe you look back at it 10 years, maybe you couldn't at 3 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a catharsis of the nation, a letting off of. Catharsis means sort of a letting off of steam, a venting of anger, frustrations, hostilities. And as these movies are all depicting, the war heroes, when they came home, were not treated like heroes like they used to be, and they expected to be. And now there's sort of a cry for recognition that if the nation sends you off to risk your life for the state, well, you should get some payment for that, right? I mean, no one wants to do this for free. And I think that's partly what's going on. They didn't get it then, so they desire this now. Okay. Okay, the overall concept of this course is not just to tick off wars and battles in periods of time in a historical fashion. I have a goal in this class. I have a theme. I have a thesis that I'm arguing. And in a sense, this course, this 18 weeks, is one long argument for that thesis. This syllabus is being built into a book. This will eventually be a book about this thesis that I have of the cause of wars, and therefore what the solutions must be. And it's important that we build the historical case, because history provides the data for our understanding of the causes of war. In a sense, I'm building a science, a social science. That's why this course is called Social Science 136. We want to build a science or an understanding of the cause of wars, not just some haphazard guess as to the cause of wars or any sort of idealistic plans for peace. Like, you know, I constantly read some of this peace literature that says, well, we all just need to love one another. I don't think that's going to do it. It hasn't done it in the past, and it's not going to in the future. We need to have an understanding of social structure and what makes people do the things they do and what makes nations do the things they do to understand why there are wars. Then if you want to cause more wars, you do more of that. And if you want to eliminate wars, you do less of whatever the cause of them is. But first we have to find out what the cause is, and I will get to that. Just hint at it a little bit tonight, but then we won't get to it again until the end of the course. But you will see as we go along, as I build my case. And it's one of the reasons I've chosen Kennedy as the main text for this book, because his thesis is similar to mine, that economic potential is a very important part of the cause of wars. Okay, and in this sort of one long argument, so don't think of each week as some long-lost, isolated lecture. Every one of them will tie together in a historical sequence. I want to present a narrative to you, a story about war that isn't just a story, that has a theme to it, something I'm building toward. So sort of keep that in mind as I build the biographies of certain characters or as I cover certain types of battles and wars. There's a reason for it, and we will weave sort of a complex web that I will tie all in at the end. Therefore, it's important that you're here for all the lectures, because it would be like if this was the book that I'm writing, it'd be like missing chapters. And when you got to the end, you'd say, well, this doesn't make any sense. Well, if it doesn't make any sense, it's because you missed chapters 8, 9, and 3, and 6. You know, and you need those to sort of fill in the gaps. Okay. By the way, I don't take roll or anything like that, simply because this is college, not high school, and you should be here because you love learning and you're interested in the subject, not because I'm making you do that. And the reason for wanting to be here is so that you understand my whole long argument. So in that light, then, I'm sort of taking a two-pronged approach here. And you should be taking notes now. As we go along, write down as many things as you can that I say, especially tonight because you don't have the syllabus. After this, it'll make it a lot easier as you follow along. But my two-pronged approach stems from an old quote from an ancient Greek that I like to use. And the quote goes something like this. It doesn't go something like this. It goes exactly like this. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. What do you think that means? Well, I've checked my source, and as far as I can tell,
what's a hedgehog?
A hedgehog is
it's a destroyer, right?
Well, no, it's a little burrowing animal that digs itself in. All right, the fox knows many things. Okay, there's two approaches to learning and understanding something. You can take a fox-like approach. You can try to approach it from a whole bunch of different angles. And know a little bit about a lot of things. You can apply this to your college career. Do I want to be a fox or do I want to be a hedgehog? The hedgehog knows one big thing. He concentrates on one thing. He knows a lot about something. He's a specialist. Really what this is a generalist and specialist dichotomy. The fox is the generalist. The hedgehog is the specialist. And my approach in this class, as is my approach in all academic endeavors here, is to sort of do both. Take a fox-like approach in your hedgehogness. In other words, we're going to be dabbling in a lot of different fields in this course. Not just history, though there's a lot of that, but we'll be doing some anthropology, sociology, some psychology, political science, social science, when we're examining economics, when we're examining the causes of wars to try to understand them. We'll sort of approach it from a whole bunch of different angles. But there's one major hedgehog theme to this whole thing, which I'm going to get to right now. Okay. Well, in 1 minute, I have one more quote to read here. If you had your syllabus, I'd have you turn to this. Just listen as I read this. This is a justification for why it's important to study history. In a sense, it's a little bit longer of an exposition of a shorter quote that you're all familiar with. You've heard the quote, those who do not understand the past are condemned to repeat it. Have you ever heard that before? Yeah, Santayana. Right, Santayana. It's emblazoned in iron, wrought iron metal on a giant wall at the Dachau concentration camp where tens and hundreds of thousands of people were sent through the ovens. And beneath that quote, those who do not understand the past are condemned to repeat it, are pictures of some of the atrocities there. And the theme there, of course, is we want to understand the past so we know what causes it, so we can avoid those same things in the future. In essence, that's what we're doing here. We want to understand war and the true causes of war, not some of the proclaimed causes you may have heard, because we can examine my claims scientifically. We can look at the evidence that I present historically from anthropology, from sociology, from economics, and so on, and you can decide for yourself whether the evidence supports the theory of these causes of war. Why? So that we can eliminate them if that's what you wish. A lengthier quote, and I think one beautifully written by Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, in his book A Study of History, goes like this, quote, "In a world that has been unified in both space and time," just listen, "a study of human affairs must be comprehensive if it is to be effective. It must include not only the whole of the living generation, but also the whole of the living generation's past. In order to save mankind, we have to learn to live together in concord in spite of traditional differences of civilization, religion, nationality, class, and race. In order to live together in concord successfully, we have to know each other. And knowing each other includes knowing each other's past, since human life, like the rest of the phenomenal universe, can be observed by human minds only as it presents itself to them on the move through time. Historical forces can be more explosive than atomic bombs." That's a powerful statement of the importance of understanding the past. See, we are all the products of our past. The present is contingent upon, it's dependent upon millions of linkages across space and time as we go back. And so when we go back in time, and I'm going to go way back in just a few minutes and bring you up to the modern period of war, we're going to be looking for the linkages that sort of explain how we got to where we are today. The problem is that there are so many contingent linkages that create, sort of cause the present from the past, and they're so complex, and the web is so complicated, even the best of historians and sociologists and psychologists can't predict the future. I mean, who could have ever known about the Berlin Wall? Who could have ever predicted that China would have had this revolution? Who could have ever predicted things in Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia? I mean, these events that are happening today by the day, by the hour, which are so exciting, are completely taking the so-called experts and authorities by surprise. So that tells us something. It tells us that our past understanding of things is pathetically poor. And because one of the guidelines of science that makes science valuable is its ability to predict. And the fact that social scientists can't predict worth a damn tells us something about the validity of the science. So therefore, I will from here on out refer to it as the social so-called sciences or social pseudosciences. All right? I have another thing I'm building up, even deeper and bigger than just the causes of war. The entire understanding of social sciences, including psychology and sociology and political so-called science and economics and so on, I think need a whole new restructuring about this, right? So we'll be dabbling in even bigger issues toward the end of the course. And I want to say, too, that since we're a small group, which is kind of nice change from having 50 or 60 students, we can have a little more interaction and discussion. So feel free to raise your hand and ask questions or argue the point with me or whatever you'd like. This will become easier to do and more appropriate toward the end of the course when you have a bigger base of knowledge from which to argue with, and as my points become more of my own subjective opinions rather than somebody else's, then I'll value your feedback even more, because that's how we all grow, is by being challenged by others. So I hope to challenge you, and in turn, I hope that you challenge me. Okay, let's get into the meat of it here. War. Okay, this course is called War: History, Causes, and Solutions. And when you read the little handout I gave you on how to be an A student, one of the things in there about how to read a book I have is look at the title of something. The title and subtitle and first few points in something, a book or a course, tells you something about where the course is going, right? So this is a course on history, causes, and solutions. And if I had room on this cover, on my book, I would put an inquiry into the history, causes, and solutions of war. It's an inquiry. We want to make an inquiry. We want to ask questions about the history, causes, and solutions of war. And so I'll open with a statement, and you can write this down verbatim, though this will all be in the syllabus when you get it. But by the way, the college is very good about Xeroxing. As thick as this damn thing is, how much would you pay for something like this? It's only $2.80, so it's pretty cheap. It's kind of nice that they're able to do it so cheaply. If I went to have this Xeroxed for you at a regular Xerox store, it'd be about $20 a copy. So the combined total of the books comes out still pretty reasonable, even though there's three plus the syllabus. All right. My thesis statement. This is the sort of one of the most important things you can write down here is the definition of war. And it's a two-part definition. War is a monstrous reversal of the nature of man. A monstrous reversal of the nature of man. What is monstrous? Monstrous is, just from Oxford's English Dictionary here, deviating from the natural order, unnatural, strange or unnatural in conduct or disposition, or of extraordinarily huge dimensions. Okay, so war is not just a reversal of the nature of man. It's a monstrous reversal. I mean, it is extraordinarily huge.
This is your definition?
Yes, that's my that's part one, definition of war. Monstrous reversal of the nature of man. What this hints at is anthropologists who argue that war is the product of man's nature. There's always been war. There always will be war. Why? Because it's in our genes. It's in the nature of the beast. We evolved in the survival of the fittest in the jungle, struggling against our fellow species and within species and between species and so on. I am rejecting that. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. Okay, so war is a monstrous reversal of the nature of man. We're not supposed to do this. We're not supposed to slaughter each other in masses of inhumanity. Okay, part two is that. Okay, so that's what war isn't, right? It's not the nature of man. Well, what is it? Part two: war is the natural condition of statism. The natural condition of statism. What do you think statism is?
You think statism, S-T-A-I-D.
Not statism, no. Statism, like in states, nations.
National entity?
Yeah.
The idea of national entity?
Yeah, statism is the idea of national entity. That's well put. What's the word we use for that? Nationalism, right? Nationalism. So war is the natural condition of statism, or you might put nationalism. I mean, what is nationalism? What do you mean when you say somebody, he's a nationalist? He's really a nationalist.
A strong identification with his nation.
Right. Strong identification with his nation. He believes in his nation. The nation, the state, is something that exists above and beyond the individual. And in many cases, it's more important than the individual. The individual should submit his life to the nation. America, love it or leave it. Germany, love it or leave it. France, love it or leave it. They all say the same thing. All nations have flags. All nations have songs. All nations have borders and things that build the concept of the nation state, that the state is bigger than the individual. This is how states justify getting individuals to sacrifice their lives for this greater good. All right. So I'm saying war is the natural condition of that concept. As soon as you have that concept, then you can have mass wars. Now, when I'm talking about war, I should specify, I'm talking about modern war. Modern total war. Not the little skirmishes where Australian Aborigines throw spears at each other in moments of heroism and bravery, or where Native American Indians would challenge each other into fights. Not that kind of stuff. I'm talking about modern total war, where millions die. Less monstrous in terms of masses of numbers that were killed.
Seemed like it was more interaction at that time. I mean, now it's artillery, you know, something far.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's not as monstrous when you think about it.
Well, but the fact that it's more removed, we call that the morality of distance. It's easier to kill masses of people. If you got to harpoon somebody with your bayonet and twist it in his gut and see his eyes bludgeoning out and he's stabbing at you, it's hard to kill a lot of people that way. I mean, it's not very efficient. And besides that, it's kind of repulsive unless you've really been brainwashed to want to do it bad. But if you are in a B-52 bomber 65,000 feet up looking through a bomb site, or actually a computerized, and all you got to do is push the button, or easier yet, you're in a silo in deep in the heart of a mountain in Montana, and all you've got to do is turn the keys, easier still. Okay. So the morality of distance allows the masses of total war casualties to occur. All right. And besides that, these previous wars that you refer to, Rome, Greece, and even in the Middle Ages, and even the dynastic wars of the 1500s and 1600s, these were fought by professional soldiers. Civilians rarely got involved. If a civilian was killed, it was extraordinary. It's pretty unusual. I mean, at the Battle of Gettysburg, one woman was shot accidentally, Jenny Wade. There's now a monument to her, the Jenny Wade House there, where the bullet went through the window, she's baking bread, boom, hits her, and she's dead, right? I mean, I know the whole story because it only happened once. All right. But within less than 100 years, we would drop a single bomb, which in 5 minutes killed 70,000 people at Hiroshima. That's a big difference. That's what I mean by the rise of total modern warfare, as opposed to the wars before that. Okay. War is one of the constants of history and has not been diminished with civilization or democracy, writes Will Durant in his great sweeping history of civilization. In fact, says Durant, in the last 3,421 years of recorded history, only 268 have seen no war. All right, so apparently war is a fairly common experience of the human endeavor to be civilized, right? I mean, almost all years, and he's probably wrong. It's probably not 268 that have seen no war. It's probably all of them have seen war. It just didn't, you know, just somewhere else in the world we didn't know about. Okay, we conduct war in spite of the cost in money. For example, World War II cost $1.5 trillion. All these statistics are in your syllabus, but I'll just tick them off for you. If you want to write them down, that's fine, but they're in there. World War II cost $1.5 trillion. How much is that? How much is that? Yeah. Well, it's not that much now. That's a good point. That is the national deficit now, isn't it? $1.5 trillion. It's frightening. Well, let me give you a clue. If you spent $1,000 a day, 365 days a year, you'd have a good time. But if you did this from the time of Christ until 1988, I did these statistics last year, that would total, okay, $1,000 a day, 365 days a year, from the time of Christ to last year, that would total $725 million. Not even $1 billion. Since 1945, the United States has spent $10 trillion on the so-called Cold War. If you spent $1 million a day, 365 days a year, I don't know what you'd do to spend that, but if you could, from the time of Christ till last year, that would total $725 billion. Not even $1 trillion, and we've spent $10 trillion since 1945. Just us, the United States. So the problem in defense spending is to figure out how far you should go without destroying from within what you're trying to protect from without, right? I mean, supposedly we're protecting ourselves from Russia, and now we're cutting this back, but we still spend an enormous amount of money. But how much more can we spend before the economy collapses and we are destroyed from within what we're trying to protect from without? Okay. For example, let me just tick off a bunch of statistics here for you that are kind of mind-blowing. The United States has the single largest gross national product on the planet. I don't know what it is, but it's huge. The United States is number one arms exporter in the world. The United States is number one in the amount of money spent on military technology. Nobody spends more money than we do on developing technology of military weapons. The United States is number one in the amount of money spent on arms development. United States is number one, has the number one number of military bases worldwide. We have more military bases than anyone. We have the largest fleet in the world. We have the most number of nuclear weapons, though this is debated whether Russia does or we do. But regardless, we got a lot, number one or number two. On the other hand, the United States is fourth in the world in literacy. I mean, 25% of the United States population is functionally illiterate. And yet we have the greatest technology in the world for weapons. We are number six in the percentage of school-age children that are actually in school. In other words, five more nations on the planet have a greater percentage of their kids in school. We're number seven in life expectancy. Six nations have people that live longer than we do. Life expectancy being linked to technology. So where are we spending our money? That's what I'm getting at here. We're number 10 in public education expenditures per capita. United States is number 10 in public health expenditures per capita. In other words, there's nine more nations that spend more money, and not percentage, but more real dollars, or whatever, on their population than we do in education and health. United States is number 13 in the student-teacher ratio in public education. Number 14 in the percentage of population with safe water. Ever seen the studies in the water in L.A.? Don't drink it. Get sparklets. All right. 13 nations have better drinking water than we do. We're number 17 in infant mortality rate. That is, 16 nations have a lower infant mortality rate than we do. All right. So in other words, we're spending so much money in our military technology, we're sacrificing other national interests. If you believe that the nation needs to spend money on something to benefit itself, how much more do you need to spend on military before the rest falls apart? We also conduct war in spite of the cost in lives. And perhaps this is even more dramatic than the cost in dollars. How many people died in Vietnam? 58,000 were killed in Vietnam. That's more than the combined total of dead in the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Spanish-American War. Well, Spanish-American War, a couple hundred died. No big deal. And the Vietnam War has gained much popular attention in the press the last couple of years for reasons we previously discussed. And if you go to the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., has anyone been there and seen it? You've seen it? It's dramatic, isn't it? It's very powerful. I mean, to see 58,000 names chiseled in marble, I guess it's marble, it's hard to see. It's hard to find it because it doesn't stand up above the ground. It actually goes into the ground. So sort of here's the level ground, which raises just a little bit, and then the rampway walks down, and as you go down, the wall progressively gets larger. And, of course, more and more names fit on the thing. And I guess they're listed by date of the casualty, right? And you see people there all the time, Vietnam War veterans having an emotional experience, and even somebody that never went, it's an emotional experience to stand there and look at 55 or 58,000 names killed in the course of, I guess, around 10 years. However, this is a cap pistol. This is nothing compared to the history of previous wars. That's why I say Vietnam is merely a spin-off from really the outcome of World War II. I mean, in the first day of the Battle of Somme in World War I, there were 60,000 dead. The first day, more were killed than in 10 years in Vietnam. And look at our reaction about the Vietnam War when we weren't behind it emotionally. We are kind of upset about 58,000 being killed. But here, people kill that many in a day when you're behind the war. 70,000 died in one night in Hamburg when the British and the American bombers bombed it. The air caught on fire. It's what they call a firestorm, where literally the air catches fire. People just burned to death. 80,000 died in Dresden in two nights. 123,000 died in Iwo Jima. 225,000 died in Tokyo in 2 days. So, I mean, we can tick off the figures like crazy. In the last 2 years of World War II, there was an average of 1 million a month killed. million a month. Total, 54 million at the end of the war. 54,800,000. Okay.
Can the Russians do like 15 million people?
It's hard to count because it depends if you count Stalin's purges of his own people. I mean, before the Nazis invaded and millions were killed in the invasion of Russia by the Nazis. Before that, Stalin was slaughtering his own people. I mean, you have to have support within before you can defend yourself from without. He had to kill off anyone that didn't support him. Estimates range, I've seen, between as low as 5 million and as high as 30 million that he killed of his own Russian people. Just staggering, the numbers. I mean, they just sort of roll off the tongue as if we're just, you know, sort of here, sort of blandly and coldly in a classroom giving these statistics. But imagine a wall for all those that died in World War II. I mean, you couldn't, they'd be building the wall. It would take longer to build the wall than it took to fight the war, to list them all off there. It'd be unbelievable. 54 million, 800,000 compared to 58,000. Okay. Well, and it's even worse than that, because if we were to have another war, a total nuclear war, it's estimated that a million would die a minute. Not a month, but a minute. Okay. So the question is how did we get in this situation? Well, and it's not that even a limited nuclear war would somehow solve the political dilemma and we would go on our merry way. It's very possible that even a first strike nuclear war, what do we mean by first strike capability? Have you ever heard this term before?
Your question was, what do you mean by first strike capability?
Yeah, first strike. Right, first missile strike. But, well, anybody can strike first. But what we mean by first strike capability is that we beat the hell out of them in the first strike and they can't strike back. Or at least we cripple them, you know, dramatically. All right, that's a first strike capability. What would it take for a first strike capability? Well, let me tell you what that would be. It would be about, they've calculated, about the equivalent of 5,000 megatons of nuclear weapons. So 5,000, if we launch the equivalent of 5,000 megatons of nuclear weapons, we would win a first strike attack on Russia. In other words, we'd hit them so bad they couldn't hit us back. We win. Problem with that line of argument, and I should put this in perspective, I say 5,000 megatons, as if megatons, we all know what that is. Let me put it in perspective here. Hiroshima, the Hiroshima bomb, was the equivalent of 20,000 tons of TNT. The Soviets exploded a bomb in the Arctic, a hydrogen bomb, the equivalent of 58 million tons of TNT. Okay. 1 million tons is 1 megaton. So 5,000 megatons would be 5,000 million tons of TNT. That's 5 billion tons of TNT. That's a hell of a lot of explosive power. I mean, again, these numbers just roll off like we know what a billion tons of TNT is like. I haven't a clue what that's like. I just know it's a lot. Okay. Well, in 1971, and let me turn to another science that I study, evolution. And let's look at a study that was done in 1971 by planetologists, people who study other planets, including the Earth, analyzing the results of the Mariner 9 mission around Mars. Part of the problem why the Mariner 9 mission was a bit of a disaster was that there was a huge dust storm surrounding Mars when it got there. So it was very difficult for it to get any pictures and data from the planet because of the dust storm. But one thing it did discover after the dust storm cleared was that the temperatures of the planet's surface, Mars, had plummeted considerably, a significant amount, because of the dust covering the planet in its atmosphere, blocking the sun's rays. Well, about 10 to 15 years later, Carl Sagan, Stephen Jay Gould, and other scientists began to explore the possibility that this could happen again on Earth, triggered by a nuclear war. This is what we call nuclear winter. That is, the massive forest fires, the massive fires from cities burning, thrusting soot and junk up into the atmosphere, and all the debris from the explosions would surround the Earth with a reasonably thick dust cloud, block the sun's rays, plummet temperatures by tens of degrees, putting us into another ice age, destroying the capacity for agricultural